I'm not a singing teacher, though I do like associating with them, which I think is close enough to come to the Association of Teachers of Singing. My name's Ian Noonan, and I'm a lecturer in mental health. It's called mental health rather than mental illness, because the focus of what we do is to try and improve people's mental health at the Florence Nightingale School of Nursing and Midwifery, King's College London. I've been asked to come and speak here, I think, because we're the first school in the country to truly integrate the arts into the curriculum for nursing. We run a culture and care strategy throughout the whole school, mostly because we think the nursing education is too narrow if people don't also study the liberal arts in some way. But also, we've introduced singing as a core skill for our children's nurses. So all children's nurses who train with us are taught to sing, taught to learn song, and taught to improvise song as part of their skill set for working on children's wards. And this is an idea that came from a young woman who's a singer-songwriter who has cystic fibrosis and noticed that song was a core part of her home life. Her mum used to sing to her all the time, particularly when she was upset or distressed about something, but nobody sang in hospitals. And there was this idea that simple things like when parents leave at the end of the day or the journey down to theatre could be transformed if the nurse was able to sing with the child. So 4 years ago, we set up the Nightingale Choir in collaboration with Voice Lab and Mary King. Mary King founded the choir, but doesn't rehearse with us. Lacquer D, who some of you may know, runs the choir now. It's still in collaboration with Voice Lab at the South End. And a little plug, if you're up early on Sunday morning and happen to be listening to Radio 4, the Nightingale Choir will be singing live from St Thomas's Chapel for Sunday worship this Sunday, including a new piece that's been commissioned and written by John Brown, who's a composer in residence in the School of Nursing. We managed to get funding from Arts Council England and the Performing Rights Society Foundation to fund a composer in residence for 2 years in the school. So, as a School of Nursing, we're quite richly involved with song. I've had singing lessons for a few years. I'm a very keen amateur singer. And through those kind of two worlds, maybe alliding, possibly colliding, I started to look at how mental illness was represented in song, and started to think that actually psychiatrists and mental health nurses, as I am, could learn a great deal from the way in which madness has been represented in song in terms of the lay history of mental illness, or the lay history of insanity, that how both classical and folk forms have represented madness tells us a lot more about the way in which people view insanity than we might learn from textbooks or from standard writings. I might just ask if you pass around some of the handouts of people who just arrived at the back. There's some more in the top corner, just so everyone's got them. So, rather than present a sort of dry academic paper, I thought we could answer a few questions together, and I'll provide some evidence, and you can think whether or not it's convincing evidence. The first question, I suppose, is why does a history of insanity need to be told? Why do we need to do anything to explore how mental illness has changed over the centuries? And I think one of the reasons for that is that in the 60s, philosopher Foucault very heavily criticised the way in which psychiatry had written its own history, that medics had made great assumptions that the changes in the way in which people were treated came about because of altruistic or philosophical ideas about liberating people who had been treated mostly through confinement and restraint. And Foucault argued that actually that really wasn't what happened. All that happened is that the way in which we control people who are mentally ill changes. So the way in which we exercise power through psychiatry has changed over the centuries. But the main bedrock of it has been this idea of restraint and control. So he challenged this idea that science is somehow neutral and that mental illness is something objective. It's a lived experience, it's something that affects all of society. And Foucault looked to literature and to art to illustrate it, but he missed a trick. He didn't look to song. And so I think we have the opportunity to to critique established histories of psychiatry by looking at how mental illness has been represented in song. Not going to concentrate too much on Foucault, he's a confusing fellow, but the quote that's most often attributed to him in terms of the critique of the history of psychiatry is that people know what they do, frequently they know why they do what they do, but what they don't know is what they do does. I think that might be enough philosophy for after dinner. But it brings into that question of looking at the motives behind some of the treatments, and that is certainly the area that's questionable. So why as told in song? Why am I looking to song for this history? There's a long history of representations of madness in Western popular and in art music, and a very complex history of the development of ideas about insanity. So from the sort of influence of the supernatural in very early civilizations to what most people working in mental health today would accept, which is a broad sweeping biological, psychological, sociological model, or one particular model that's used a lot in psychosis, the stress vulnerability model. This is a very interesting and sort of applicable to all model of mental illness. It says mental illness occurs when the stress in somebody's life exceeds their ability to cope with it. That everyone has an innate vulnerability to some degree that might depend on what you inherited, on your early life experiences, on how you cope with things, how you solve problems, and that combined with different levels of stress is the thing that trips people up into mental illness. Very simple model. So my question really is, does song offer a possible primary source to help us explore lay or popular beliefs about mental illness? Now I've tried to represent in one slide a complete overview of the history of insanity. The thing that's I suppose interesting when you read historical textbooks about psychiatry is that it's described as a linear history. That there was a period of time in sort of medieval Western Europe where large things were attributed to the supernatural, to diabolic possession and religious enthusiasm. And then in the Renaissance, we look back to the Greek ideas of humoral and holistic medicalization of madness, where through a period of rationalization and placing mental illness in the mind rather than in the body, and then through the 19th century's ideas about somatic illnesses, nervous maladies, refined temperaments, and there was a very large number of women diagnosed as having mental illnesses and admitted to asylums, the feminization of hysteria. Towards the end of the 19th century, people came up with other theories because they'd admitted all of these people to asylums and found that the treatments were largely unsuccessful, nothing worked, so we had to find out something else, some other cause for it. And ideas of degenerationism, we looked at genetics and neuropathology, this idea that mental illness was inherited and that our efforts might be better spent preventing people with mental illnesses from having children, with the rise of the eugenics movement, and at the same time the rise of the psychology movement. Most of the 21st century, after Freud, was taken up by meaning, trying to understand the lived experience of somebody who's mentally ill, and psychopharmacology. So all into one slide. And Foucault's criticism was that it just didn't work like this. There weren't triggers that made us move from one way of viewing mental illness to the other. That there were themes that kind of led right through the history of psychiatry. A theme of social and physical exclusion, a theme of the idea of mysterious forces of cosmic tragedy, as we'll see certainly in the first song we look at. A period of great confinement, where we locked everyone away. An idea that insanity in some way was the reverse of reason. When logic stops making sense, insanity is something that's quite natural to turn to, perhaps something quite beautiful to turn to. And then the sort of 19th and 20th century concept of mental illness. So, a great deal to try and represent on one slide, but I want to focus more on the songs than the history for this evening. If anyone's particularly interested, there's an excellent and very short summary by Roy Porter, A Brief History of Madness, which is worth perhaps a two train journey read, I think. It doesn't take much longer than that. So, I'd like to start by looking at an example of a song, possibly from around 1700. It's difficult to date this song because it's based on a series of poems, Thomas Bedlam poems that dated from 1600 onwards. This particular song, The Paper, is watermarked around 1690, so the song is probably around 1700 or so, at a rough guess, that depicts Thomas Bedlam. So, forth from my dark and dismal cell, or from the dark abyss of hell, mad Tommy's come to view the world again, to see if he can cure his distempered brain. Fears and cares oppress my soul. Hark, how the angry furies howl. Pluto laughs, and Proserpine is glad to see poor angry Tom of Bedlam mad. Through the world I wander night and day to find my straggling senses. In an angry mood I met old Time with his Pentateuch of tenses. When me he spies, away he flies, for Time he stays for no man. In vain with cries I rend the skies, for pity is not common. Cold and comfort less I be. Help, help, or help, or else I die. Hark, I hear Apollo's team, the carman gins to whistle. Chaste Diana bends her bow, and the boar begins to bristle. Come Vulcan with tools and with tackles, to knock off my troublesome shackles. Bid Charles make ready his wain, to bring me my senses again. I'll leave you just with the first verse, if that's okay. Now, just to take the text first of all, the term Tom of Bedlam was used in early modern Britain and later to describe beggars and vagrants who had feigned or who had mental illness and had been discharged from the Bethlehem Hospital. There was a myth that people discharged from the Bethlehem were given a metal plate to wear on their arm which licensed them to beg and excluded them from vagrancy laws. So someone who had a mental illness and had been in hospital didn't have to work or be in a workhouse, they were allowed to beg. This may have been the case for a very few people, but of course once the idea caught on, any beggar would claim to be discharged from Bethlehem Hospital. One of the few occasions where people would claim that they were mentally ill to try and justify things. The Bethlehem Hospital was founded in London in 1247. It's the earliest psychiatric hospital in effect in the world. It was originally a priory that took in people who were disturbed, and it wasn't until 1310 that it was recorded as a hospital. And in 1402 as a hospital for lunatics. But by the middle of the 16th century, it had received royal foundation for the reception of lunatics, and in 1676 was rebuilt near London Wall. In 1815, it moved to what's now the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth, and subsequently in the 1930s out to where the Bethlehem Royal Hospital is now in Eden Park in Beckenham in Kent. So it still exists. It's part of the South London and Maudsley NHS Trust, and has a number of specialist units and inpatient psychiatric units. In the song, so Tom says, forth from my dark and dismal cell, or from the dark abyss of hell. It's quite a bold description of what the Bedlam may well have been like. But we don't know the purpose of any song, whether it was written to dramatise, or written to illustrate, or written to record, or possibly all three. So we want to try and triangulate it with other sources, triangulate it with other pieces of evidence, to see, does this description in the song match what else we might think about the Bethlehem? There aren't any contemporary pictures of the Bethlehem inside. There are engravings of the outside of the building, but from the 17th century. But we do have a report just at the end of the 16th century. In 1598, the Bridewell governors were shamed into inspecting the place, and nothing had been spent on the upkeep of the buildings. And they noticed that the great vault, which was a cesspit that was in the middle of the building, The building was a series of corridors around a pit into which everything was tipped. Badly needed emptying. They said, we do find diverse other defaults in the said house in such sort that it is not fit for any man to dwell in, which was left by the keeper, so the person who's supposed to be looking after the house has moved out, for that it is so loathsomely and filthily kept that any man to come into the said house would risk his life. So, as a description of a hospital, thought from my dark and dismal cell, is probably quite accurate. We also have in the song a description of symptoms. Symptoms of mental illness. Tom says, fears and cares oppress my soul, which most likely would refer to symptoms of anxiety and depression. Hark how the angry furies howl, which most likely would refer to some auditory hallucination, unless the furies really are present. Pluto laughs and Proserpine is glad to see poor angry Tom of Bedlam mad, are delusional beliefs. He's attributing various gods to having, I suppose, influence in his life, but also to mocking him. The other part of the song that I think is really interesting in terms of how mental illness was understood at the beginning of the 18th century or end of the 17th century is that he says, he's come to view the world again to see if he can cure his distempered brain. Now, a distempered brain refers to a humoral system of medicine that, if we look at histories of medicine, they would suggest had been rejected by 1550, 1600. As soon as Descartes on the scene, that people are looking at much more rational and physiological causes for mental illness. But here we have a description of a distempered brain. So to think about what that might mean, there are four humours in this kind of, it's a sort of mixture of Greek ideas with folklore, it all rolled together. The four humours are yellow bile, black bile, phlegm and blood. Each humour has a particular quality to it, a season associated with it, an element, and also if you have too much of it, the effect you have is to become choleric, melancholic, phlegmatic or sanguine. So the aim of treatment in humoral medicine was to try and achieve some sort of balance. The example most often given is one of a fever. Fever is hot and dry, so the cause must be too much yellow bile. In order to treat that, you need to increase the opposite humour, which is phlegm, cold and moist, by prescribing, for instance, cold baths. Very sensible. Something we would do now, still, for fevers, to have tepid baths. We apply that to mental illness. In 1621, in the Anatomy of Melancholia, Robert Burton wrote that distempered or distemperature of the spleen creates an excess of yellow bile, which results in brutal madness of the most dangerous mania. Whereas an excess of black bile results in melancholia. Remedies included diet, exercise, distraction, and travel. Not that dissimilar to the nice guidelines for the management of depression. Robert Burton goes on, however, also to suggest purgatives, bloodletting, and herbal remedies, which the nice guidelines aren't quite so keen on. He said that there was only one possible cure for melancholic maids, and that was marriage. We know now that marriage protects men's mental health. I'm afraid it doesn't have quite the same benefit for women's mental health. I'll leave that one with you. So we have this description in the song of a distempered brain a good century later than medical textbooks would suggest. Science had moved on. That in labels, in popular views, a humoral approach was still what was being sung about. Towards the end of the first verse, Tom sings, come Vulcan with tools and with tackles to knock off my troublesome shackles. And it's not just a good rhyme. I think if we look at a portrait of James Norris that was taken or drawn from life as an inpatient at Bethlehem Hospital, albeit a century or so later, we can see that people were shackled. James Norris was a famous insane American who had been riveted alive in iron for many years, confined in that state by chains 12 inches long to an upright massive bar in a cell in the bedroom. And people were so appalled at the way that he had been kept. It was very popular Sunday afternoon activity to go and visit the bedroom, to pay and go and look at the lunatics. But some people saw this chap and protested. six politicians, in fact, went to view him, impressed about the way he'd been kept. They said that he was sane, that there was no reason he should be kept in there. He was released and unfortunately died of pneumonia 4 weeks later. I think because he wasn't able to care for himself in any way. He'd been so institutionalised. At least in this position he had been upright, which is much better for chest infections than lying down, and he'd been given food and water every day, or food and beer every day. Water wasn't particularly safe. But left his own devices, he spent a lot of time laid down, developed chest infection, and died. So the idea of this call to Vulcan to come with tools and tackles to knock off troublesome shackles is well supported by images in art of what looked like it's happening inside the Bethlehem Hospital. So we can take just one folk song and think, what does it tell us about the way in which mental illness was understood in a humoral sense? Or what does it describe about the places where people were being cared for, match it with other reports and other images? If we look at another example of a mad song, and this time take a more musicological approach to understanding it, I'll play you Purcell's Mad Bess in just a moment, and whether you prefer the words, or I'll put the words up, but you'll have the music in the handout. It's a very similar structure to Tom of Bedlam. There are alternating strophes of description of Bess and then content in direct speech. It's very rich in allegorical references to the gods and to the spheres, but there are also pastoral references and an almost romanticised view of illness. There's very aesthetic, excessively beautiful word colouring of her, an illustration of her lovesick melancholy, and Roper describes a sort of lyrical delight that's provoked by scenes of madness. And I think there's a possible allure of Bess for the listener. We might choose some examples of that once we've had a listen. So let me see if I can master this. Thank you. obvious similarities in structure between Tom of Bedlam and Mad Bess. I mean, words that are quoted change the meter that are the same between the two. But I think there's a profound difference. That there's a love story for Bess. This is something that burdens women in song and opera from this point forward, that their madness is nearly always associated with some wrongdoing, some spurned love, some rejection, some unrequited love, intense jealousy, whereas men's madness from this point forward tends to be to do with rage, or temporary insanity in order to fight somebody or to right some wrong. There's also a big difference in Bess's madness because it has this idea of madness being a rejection of normality. That Bess sings, since the world is so mad, she can hope for no cure. That there's actually an idea that she has some escape, some... I'm trying to think what the word is. It's escaped me at the moment. There's some emancipation in her madness. That the last stanza where it says, since the world is so mad she can hope for no cure, who is content, does all sorrow prevent, and Bess in her straw, whilst free from the law, in her thoughts is as great, great as a king. There's some sort of illusion to her achieving greatness in this insanity. There's something attractive about it, which doesn't happen in arias where men go mad, and I think is the sort of forerunner for the mad scene that dominated the 18th and first half of the 19th century. So we first saw sort of classical mad scenes in Handel's Orlando, which is a regal, temporary adjustment to love, brief jealousy, etc. And they're often located in pastoral scenes. But as I'm sure you know, they became a very popular convention in 19th century Italian and French opera and had a dual function of dramatic tension and an opportunity to show off the singer's talents. They were largely associated with women who have in some way been wronged or acted immorally, and the greatest exponents were Donizetti and Bellini. The mad scene fell out of fashion by the middle of the 19th century. We'll talk about that in a little moment as to why that might be. But most mad scenes from this bel canto period dealt with some sort of conflict between the surrounding characterised by indifferent rationality, where brute force or authority or aspiration, specifically the conduct of the protagonists, and a life space where freedom and affection can develop. So in many cases, the heroine of the opera actually breaks down because of conflict between these worlds, becomes mentally ill, but in that mental illness, finds her escape. So one of the most famous examples we'll look at together is from Lucia di Lammermoor, where Lucia is forced into marriage with Arturo for political and financial advantage by her brother and her brother Enrico, and he's forged a letter from Lucia's true love, Edgardo, claiming that he is now pledged to another woman. The moment we're going to look at is after the wedding contract has been signed and Edgardo returns. Lucia collapses. She's murdered Arturo, and returns to the wedding party, recalling her marriage, but in her mind and vision to Edgardo. And very specifically, at the end of the aria, she believes she's in heaven. This is the point where she dies. I think her spirit is now free. There's this idea that through what otherwise very brutal murder and hallucination, and this freedom is represented depending on which performance you look at, flute or glass harmonica. She's free from her unwanted husband and life herself, free from her brother's oppression. I saw the recent production at E&O, all the things that might have involved. And there's a sense of transcendence, a sense of heaven, liberty and freedom, which I think is unique to the way in which mental illness was viewed in the middle of the 19th century. So, let's try that. an extraordinary representation of a psychotic mania, which would be the only thing that could possibly explain the hallucination of the wedding scene and her murder. And in that context, this great sense of transcendence, of liberty, of freedom, of release. That sense of the coloratura almost, you know, taking her out of the range of a soprano normal, or, you know, this out of the range of a human voice, out of the thing that is natural. That only occurs and was only seen as occurring in mental illness in the first half of the 19th century. And we have to understand in context what was happening in terms of psychiatry around this period to try and make sense of that very impressionistic view of madness. People who are manic are not happy, naive, childlike, free. That if you believe that you are very powerful and other people don't, it's a very difficult situation to be in. People who are manic and elated are often elated and angry because they're elated and they have these special powers and abilities, but nobody else understands them or believes them, and they're incredibly frustrated by the slow pace of everyone else around them. But that's certainly not what is depicted in Lucia. So to kind of contextualise that in terms of psychiatry, suddenly, by the beginning of beginning of the 19th century, it was okay to have someone in your family who was mentally ill. To talk about mental illness wasn't so stigmatised. And the main trigger for this, most people would accept, is the fact that George III was perceived to have had several episodes of mental illness. Now, we know now that it was most likely to be porphyria, which is a neurological condition that was causing this, but at the time, we didn't. At the time, people thought that he was mentally ill and explored all sorts of treatments for mental illness. The picture you see on the right is a treatment chair that was sent over by an American physician, one of the co-signers of the American Declaration of Independence, who suggested and recommended this as a treatment for George III. It's a treatment chair in which the patient straps in until they start behaving in a more acceptable way. Moral treatment meant correcting behaviour. Now, we didn't use this for George III. His physician wouldn't, but it was sent over to the UK. And you can see that it's providing the only need not to leave the chair. Only restraints, and then this thing that blocks out sight and sound, apart from the therapist or the physician who would stand next to you and whisper good things to try and correct the bad things that you might be experiencing. And because of this sudden realisation that the treatments we used for people, which were mostly restraint, we couldn't use on George III, people started investigating other possible treatments. The Tuke brothers opened the York Retreats, and were the first physicians or lunatic asylum attendants to remove restraints. The idealised asylum at this point started to replace madhouses. There's moral treatment, work therapy, escape from the trials of life, and a very pastoral, almost idyllic life. In 1808, there was an act recommending the erection of rape-supported asylums in the UK. And the 19th century saw a constant rise of public asylums. By the end of the century, the birth of psychiatry. But the asylums were very expensive, full to birth very quickly. Tuke described the York Retreat as a place in which the unhappy might obtain a refuge, a quiet haven in which the shattered bark might find a means of reparation or of safety. But by 1870, towards the end of the century, less than 8% of the population who were in asylums were thought to be curable. So, in relatively quick time, a period of 70 years or so, we went from seeing mental illness as something that was acceptable and treatable, investing a huge amount of money in asylums, but then filling them up and discovering that the people we filled them up with weren't getting any better. So, there was a rejection, in some ways, of the asylum movement and the cost that it caused. And at the same time, there's this political rejection and questions about the cost of psychiatry. We see in opera physical illness becoming the new black for a desirable escape from poverty and moral difficulty. So in Traviata or Bohème, it's tuberculosis. Madness loses its dramatic allure, At the same time, there's a huge rise in hysterical illnesses and admissions in women in psychiatry. Now, in terms of qualitative research, these things, we can't say they definitely have a causal effect on each other, but it's interesting to note that they happen at the same time. That chronic patients in asylum support maybe argue that mental illness must be hereditary, untreatable, and a burden to society. We've seen a rise of the eugenics movement, medical psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and the removal, for a good 50 years or so, of mental illness as a feature in opera. The 1845 Lunatics Act, the asylum was lauded as the solution to lunacy, the care and treatment, particularly by the doctors running them. This was also a period of massive growth in the number of asylums and the number of patients held in them. And it marked this shift from optimism to pessimism again, and concern about incurable and chronic cases. Hopefully we should have an example of this. So yes, if we look at the total number of women who were in asylums in the 1860s, 1861, some data I've got preparing for you to turn the screw, we're not going to touch on too much today, but it's why the governesses are highlighted. But there was a vast number of women who were admitted to asylums. Governesses, alarmingly, represented a much larger percentage of any other woman, and perhaps were in this position of being in opposition to the society that was around them, that there was a sense of oppression. They were neither part of the family nor servant. They were often seen as sexually repressed, often may have been having affairs with the fathers of the family, and deemed sexually immoral, which is enough to get you into an asylum at that time. So there was a kind of distasteful or difficult to maintain that idea of escapism and liberty in the mad scene of the first half of the century. And we have a gap until post-Freud, where we see Greek legends used as a metaphor for the emotional human condition, where we have this idea of psychoanalytic operas. Now, those whole operas, and I think we could add certainly Peter Grimes in there, and maybe others. We might have to say for next year, because there's the psychoanalytic interpretation of opera, kind of kicked off by Hans Keller and colleagues, is very well written about, and less so than the representation of madness in opera. But madness no longer represents a release or beauty or freedom, but rather tragedy, death and despair. So it's a descent into hell rather than ascent to heaven. If we take one example of that, that lets us look back to the 18th century as well as to the 20th, the rate of progress, we can see in these slides Hogarth's series of prints of the rate of progress, and maybe compare them with what Auden and Stravinsky come up with. That in Hogarth's series, there's a very clear moral model for Tom Insanity. Having inherited lots of money, gets suited and booted, and lives it up in high society in London, but also in low society in London, in the whoring house. There's a subplot, perhaps, in the Hogarth prints that doesn't come across brilliantly here, that Tom's insanity may be induced by syphilis. He's got mercury bottles at the end of his sword, a very clear, sort of flaccid phallic object in this depiction, pointing at the cure or the treatment for syphilis, and also you can see in the ladies of the whorehouse have malt covering up their syphilitic sores with makeup. But he ends up in the bedroom, in his dark and dismal cell, in Hogarth's prints, believing that he is Apollo. So in Hogarth's story, there's this very clear moral model, that his immorality is the thing that has led to his mental illness, be it just immorality in terms of his behaviour or the consequence of the immorality and his syphilis that's caused his illness. But in the Auden and Stravinsky collaboration, The Rates of Progress, we have a very different model. And a model that could only exist after Freud and more specifically after Jung. In The Rates of Progress of Stravinsky and Auden, we're going to listen to a little excerpt in a minute, Shadow's folk-like tune and the sort of mocking chorus of Madman link musically back to the C major chorus and the musical material of the Roaring Boys and Halls in the brothel scene. So this supports the moral model. It doesn't detract too much from Hogarth's original. There is still this sense of Tom Rakewell's immoral behaviour leading to his madness. But there's a new concept. There is no shadow in Hogarth's print. And there's clearly a Jungian concept of shadow. I would suggest, as many others have, the idea that Nick Shadow, rather than being a melodramatic sort of Mephistopheles, is actually part of Tom himself. Jung describes the shadow as the dark aspects of personality of which one can only become conscious only through considerable moral effort. And in Jungian psychology, the shadow is a part of the unconscious mind, usually consisting of a repressed weakness. Jung wrote, "Everyone carries a shadow, and the less it is embodied in the individual's conscious life, the blacker and denser it is." And Auden had a particular interest in Freud and underwent Jungian psychotherapy, particularly searching for creativity and meaning. So I want to play an example of a duet. Not the scene in Bedlam where Tom has got married, but the scene just before it, where what's actually represented is, I would argue, Tom considering suicide. We have Nick Shadow handing Tom a steel, a halter, poison, the gun, very clearly tools for suicide, next to his grave. And in this duet, we have, at one point, Tom singing an almost pastoral elegy, whilst Nick Shadow is singing this mocking folk song-like idea that the sins that Tom has done will catch up with him. And I think this is the neatest and clearest representation of cognitive dissonance in music that you will find. If you think about these being two aspects of Tom and the way in which Stravinsky has written them to play together, cognitive dissonance is a state of distress that's caused when someone's concept self and real self is too far apart to maintain. Now, Rogers, who was a bit of an anti-psychiatrist in some ways and wrote about client-centered counselling, first described these concepts of concept self and real self. But he argues that the importance of client-centered counselling and therapy is to accept both concept self and real self, to have unconditional positive regard for the person that you're listening to, so that they don't have to invest the energy in maintaining the two. Now, slight guess, you might work out who this is, Lisa, but the best example I can think of in one of my friends, I had someone who, after many years with her partner, had an affair, and he could tell that there was something wrong in the relationship and asked whether she'd met someone new. And she said no, she hadn't met somebody new, because the person she's having an affair with was an old friend, someone who'd known for years. And she tried to persuade me that she wasn't lying to him, because her concept self was someone who was truthful and faithful. Whereas her real self was someone who had had an affair and was willing to lie to cover it up to try and protect her partner. But it's very difficult to accept and acknowledge both parts of yourself when you try to represent yourself in the faithful, truthful light. Now, what Rogers would argue is people become unwell when they invest a great deal of effort in maintaining the two, rather than accepting who you are. So here we have, in Stravinsky's Great Progress, a duet of cognitive dissonance. This is the most tense point in the opera, where Tom could have just killed himself. We've ended very differently. And where Auden and Stravinsky have collaborated to create this musical example of cognitive dissonance.
You have the score for the excerpt in your handouts, if you want to.
Oh.
So, an incredibly dramatic scene, but from a musicological point of view, Stravinsky uses this technique of stratification. You have these two separate lines that are interrupted, Tom's song and Nick's song, and then they come back. You know, once you've had a bit of Tom, then a bit of Nick, and a bit of Tom, they continue with very contrasting material, alternating, and then the two combine, which, to my mind, is a musical demonstration of these kind of battle with himself and the fact that they are both the same person. I think there's also the idea of why is it that Shadow then comes up with this game of chance and cards at the end of this scene? You know, he's made his deal. The deal is Tom's life. Why isn't it taken? If it really was another character, if he really was just the devil, and not the devil that's inside him, then he would have taken it, surely. There are one or two other clues, I think, in the text. There's a wonderful line when Tom wakes up from a dream, the dream of the machine that turns stone into bread, and it says, "Who's there?" And Shadow answers, "Your Shadow Master." And the one and only place in the libretto where Shadow is written with a lowercase s. And I don't think it's an Auden typo. I think it must be that it is your Shadow and not your Nick Shadow. Perhaps maybe reading too much into that one line, but this idea that the two are integrated could only exist after Jung. The other main philosophical drive in psychiatry in the first half of the 20th century is that of existentialism. The relationship between existentialism and psychiatry largely came out of Viktor Frankl's work, who was a psychologist and neurologist who was in a prisoner of war camp and started to observe how it was that people made sense of their experience.
Oh gosh.
I'm getting different cues from people in the front row. I've got about another 10 minutes of material. Is that allowed, Isaac?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's difficult to stop once I get started. Frankl came up with this logotherapy that he developed from observing how people made sense of their experience. And this influenced psychiatry greatly in the 20th century, that the meaning of someone's experience became much more important than maybe how it fitted in with a diagnosis. And I found one example, I think, of expressionistic representation of madness in song rather than impressionistic. Everything we've looked at so far is what madness looks like from the outside. Whereas in Maxwell Davis's 8 Songs for a Mad King, we have what madness feels like, and a representation of the experience and the feeling of madness. Let me just play you a short example. The Phantom Queen.
You strike you.
Now, without question, there's no escape. There's no freedom. There's nothing emancipating in the voice. The pastoral element, the sort of inherited tradition of massing, is still there in the instrumental accompaniment. That perhaps Ravis isn't starting from a completely new point, but the representation of madness in the song is one, without question, that's expressionistic. It is conveying the experience, the distress, the pain of thinking that somebody has been replaced. A particular delusional disorder that someone near to you or love, that someone you love that's been replaced by someone else. Which, in a 19th century context, would have looked comic. But after the rise of expressionism and existentialism, and man's search for meaning in the first half of the 20th century, it's tragic. It's painful to listen to. I find it very painful to sing. But I've given a few examples of where psychiatry and song have lined up. But the last musical example, I think, takes us back to Tom of Bedlam. Tom of Bedlam is a folk song. It's something that's dramatising a tradition of understanding of mental illness in a song, as is the excerpt from Guys and Dolls, which we just heard a little snippet of before.
It says he, the average unmarried
Davis. But the other is to suggest that we too seriously and think, well, you know, this isn't an accurate description of somatoform disorders. But what it is, it demonstrates how, 50 years after Freud, his ideas about conversion disorders, his ideas about hysteria, are completely integrated into culture in a way that people understand it. So what Song may offer us isn't necessarily an exact representation of what psychiatry thinks its history is, but it does offer us, perhaps, what society sees as the history of mental illness. And that's where I think the potential for future research lies. So changes in how mental illness is understood are represented in music, as well as other art forms. And on its own, musical representation is dramatic, not intended to be an objective report, but I would suggest triangulated or sort of jigsaw fixed with other art and historical sources. It offers a rich and deep commentary on changing views and practices. Music may offer an insight into lay or popular opinions about insanity, and a public rather than a professional view, which I think is important. This challenges the idea that history is purely linear and supports the theory that medicine and psychiatry view their progression as scientific development, whereas changes more often occur for sociological reasons. Okay, what I mean by that, possibly two that have been shoved together, is that in music we're very happy to have the idea of a long history that composers now are not composing only in the 21st century. They're composing with a history of species counterpoint, of four-part harmony, of expanded tonality, of atonality, of avant-garde music. All of that history forms the multi-layered onion that is composition of song today. Whereas psychiatrists tended to see its history as staged, and the idea that with each new discovery, new development, what's gone before is left behind. But the way in which insanity is represented in song doesn't fit with that. That the inherited tradition stays with it in the song, and maybe we need to learn from that in terms of how we view the history of mental illness. And I think there are other possible areas for research. The reason I put this there is because one of the things that excites me most about my job and role at King's at the moment is that we're doing all sorts of collaborative projects with the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, with the Royal College, with VoiceLab, and we're open to new offers for collaboration. So, the effect of music on madness in terms of both cause, whether music can cause someone to go insane, and in treatment. We're working with Norma Robbins at the moment, developing, again, singing for nurses who work with people with dementia. The impact of mental illness on composers and their works has been reasonably well documented, but the impact of mental illness on performers less so, and the relationship between mental illness and creativity. I think also psychoanalytic interpretation of song to inform performance and to inform practice. One of my colleagues when I was a music student, Sharon Choa, gave one of the most beautiful lecture recitals that I ever remember, where she subjected a Bach solo violin suite to Schenkerian analysis and then demonstrated how it had informed her performance. And I'm not sure there's much point in analysis unless it's for that. So I wonder whether there's a scope to think about how might we use the techniques of psychoanalysis to analyse song to inform performance? And if people want to collaborate on that, then please do get in touch. Thank you very much for listening.